Jürgen, yesterday we learned about the International Toilet Museum, and today we get the grass to ass process from the World Health Organization. This is a rich experience, isn't it? Let me just say to anyone, any child in Denmark watching online, please direct your complaints to Jürgen and not to the... Okay, one last speaker in this session, and then we'll open it up for some questions. David Atchison is the Managing Director of Food and Import Safety with Levitt Brothers. Please keep it clean, David, all right?
I don't know. How can I possibly follow that one? All righty. I'm afraid you used up my 38 seconds that I was planning on using, so I better get moving here. What I want to talk about is to continue the focus on food safety. And last 7 years, I was heading up the food safety at the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, so a lot of what I'm going to speak to is going to be U.S.-centric and really sort of try to take it down to the pragmatic level. As we're trying to build a system, what are some of the challenges that we're going to be facing? A lot of this focuses on the global food supply, the interaction between the General Mills of this world and right down to the local farmers. What are some of the challenges that are built into this? And then finally, sort of begin to think about the opportunities. So what are the changes and the challenges that we're having to deal with? And again, this is a U.S.-centric slide, but I think it pertains to Canada and the EU. Consumers are demanding food 24/7, year-round, and all of us in the developed world want to go into any convenience store any time of the day and get any kind of food that we desire. This is driving the global food supply. About 15% of food is now imported into the United States. There's been a steady increase. I think in Canada it's a lot more than that. You take aquacultured seafood, it's about 80% in the U.S. You take fresh produce, it's 50 to 60%. Other things are a lot less. But point is that the importation track is going up. We in the U.S. are importing from over 150 countries. It's coming through 300 ports. And in order to import food into the United States, you have to be registered with the U.S. government if you're an FDA-regulated product. And there are over 200,000 foreign facilities that are registered with the FDA, all of whom are shipping food into the United States. If you compare that with domestically in the U.S., it's about 150,000. So the complexity is really where I'm going at here, is you've got a vast, complex network in the food systems. On top of that, the distribution systems are very broad and very fast. We have shifted from the notion of warehouse stocking vast quantities of food to the just-in-time concept, and particularly when you're dealing with fresh produce and people want their fresh strawberries in the supermarket, you don't have many days to get them there, and they could be coming from almost anywhere in the world. We're dealing with massive variation in practices and the lack of consistent standards, and this applies domestically in the U.S. as well as globally. We're also compounding all of this by the fact that we're finding more outbreaks. And essentially, certainly in the United States, as I'm sure many of you are aware, and I'm going to talk about a couple of those because I think they illustrate the complexities of the global supply chain, but the greater number of outbreaks and the erosion of public health infrastructure, at least in the United States, to investigate outbreaks, meaning the response is slower, so when something bad happens, it continues to smolder and go on for weeks and weeks and weeks, is driving media attention, and it's driving a lack of consumer confidence. And I should have added to this, it is now driving regulatory change. And it's classic in the U.S., as I think it will resonate with many of you, is that when you get this sort of conflagration of media attention, consumer action, then our Congress will step in to fix the problem because nobody else can, which is typically a disaster. That's my attempt at humor. All right. Yes, maybe it's true. It's not funny. You're right. Okay. Let's sort of take this down to the practical food safety level. I won't get as graphic as Sjogren, but we're dealing with two big areas: non-deliberate contamination, and I've just listed some things up here: hepatitis A in green onions, Salmonella St. Paul in hot peppers. The things that are in red on this slide are related to large outbreaks of illness in the United States, and the red ones have come from products that were produced outside of the U.S. The ones in black are domestic. And if we just pick a couple of these, Salmonella, St. Paul, and hot peppers. I'm going to dive into this one in a bit more depth in just a moment, But that was the situation where we were dealing with a big multi-state outbreak of salmonella, ultimately tracked back to a product coming from Mexico. Next one down, E. coli in spinach. That was a 2006 outbreak, affected hundreds of people. That was entirely domestic and arguably very similar issues. Small patch of peppers in Mexico led to multi-state hundreds of illnesses. Small patch in California with spinach, same deal, different pathogen. Down at the bottom here, I put deliberate contamination. Now, this is something that we have to think about, because this is a shift, and you've got to question how the economics and the social drivers are impacting this. Two examples, melamine in wheat gluten, and I'm going to dive into that in a bit more depth in a moment, and melamine in dairy products. Both of these were done with the desire for economic gain. They weren't done to cause harm, because then the game is up. It's all over. So long as you can keep doing it and making an extra buck, you're going to be able to succeed. As soon as the authorities figure it out, the game is up. But as we move forward and we start to think about the global consequences of the food supply, there will be people out there who are going to look for a way to bend the system. And that's got to be kept in mind. All right, let me take my first of two examples. And they're very different, but I think they illustrate the complexities of the global food supply. First of all, the Salmonella St. Paul situation. This was a 2008 huge outbreak in the U.S. It went on for months, ended up with about 1,400 cases in 43 states, which when you add the multiplier of the people who don't go and visit the physician, you're dealing with tens of thousands of people who were infected. It began with essentially pointing towards tomatoes, and the tomato tracebacks led us to multiple farms in at least two different countries. And then the epidemiology was repeated in late June, early July, and it suggested it was, the tomatoes are still in there, but it was also hot peppers. So we at the FDA were tracing back the peppers, and we found a distribution center in McAllen, Texas, that was part of the traceback. Went in there, sampled some of the jalapeno peppers that were sitting in that distribution facility, and found the outbreak strain on the peppers. So, okay, we got it. Now, did the contamination occur in that distribution center in Mexico, in Texas, or did it come from where the peppers were grown, which was Mexico? Well, you keep tracking back. And my next slide really illustrates the complexities of what I'm talking about. And I'm not going to take the 25 minutes it would take to go through this slide, but what I want to illustrate is this red box closest to me is where that positive sample was found at the distribution center. If you track back the red lines, it takes you up to a small grower in a state in Mexico. FDA went to that farm, and interestingly, they were growing tomatoes and jalapeno peppers, and they had salmonella on that farm, but it was not the outbreak strain. So you go back and you look at this second box in the middle of the slide where the first red arrow is going to, the packing facility in Nuevo León. Where else are they getting their peppers? Well, that's the rest of the slide. And so you start to track back and you go on to other farms, and over there on the right-hand side with the light green box was another grower. Go into that farm, and we found the outbreak strain in residual peppers that were still on the farm, as well as the irrigation water. Now, that's the outbreak strain by genetic comparison. So we've essentially, what we've got here is a multi-state outbreak that takes you right back to a small farm in Mexico. What we learned in Mexico was there is strong regulations around tomatoes because of the economic consequences when they screw up, because of what we in the U.S. will do in terms of closing the border. Peppers, now we haven't seen a problem with peppers. They're essentially unregulated. The Mexican government doesn't know who's growing peppers. And there are no consistent standards for growing peppers. That will probably change. But you can see the complexities of this system. I want to take a different perspective. I want to talk about melamine in 2007. And I think this gets to your point. This is an example where it began in animals, and it was seen in animals, and I think you're absolutely right. There's a key message here. Began with sick pets, consumer complaints, calls to the FDA, go to the firm that's making this pet food. What have you done differently? What's going on here? What is this? At this stage, nobody knew it was melamine. It was just something that was causing renal failure in dogs and cats. So you go to that point, and the only thing they changed was their supplier of wheat gluten, nothing else. So, all right, what did you do? Well, you start to build a picture. And down here in the purple box, the pet food manufacturers making pet food, making pets sick, they're getting it from an importer. The importer is getting it from China, single supplier in China. So you start to ask more questions. You talk to more pet food manufacturers. There are more reports coming in of people reporting sick animals. And we start to link it to 14 pet food manufacturers. 5 U.S. importers and 2 Chinese suppliers. We also start to learn, complexity, that some of the scraps from this pet food is heading up into feed ingredient manufacturers. So not only is it going into the pet food environment, the stuff that they don't want to feed the pets, that's basically the stuff that falls on the floor or is left over at the end of a run, gets shipped up to animal feed. From there, where's it going to? It's going to a feed mill, it's mixing in with other ingredients, and it's going into poultry farms and hog farms. Now, at this point, we now know it's melamine and cyanuric acid that are causing the problem, and it's an interesting scientific twist that melamine alone is not particularly problematic, cyanuric acid alone is not problematic, and one is a breakdown product of the other. You put the two together at low concentrations, they form crystals in the renal tracts and essentially cause renal failure. It's an interesting phenomena, but the combination of the two is what is deadly. So we've now got concern that we're heading into the human food chain. It's going into poultry farms and it's going into hog farms. So you're checking levels in the poultry, in the eggs, in the pork, and essentially by this stage it's so far diluted out it really isn't a concern. Okay, next complexity is we then find as we're talking to the importers that they've shipped this stuff up to Canada as well. So of course we're immediately on the phone to Janet and her colleagues when she was working in the Canadian government saying, hey guys, you've got a problem in Canada, just like we've got. So they go and investigate and they call us back and say, well, I hate to tell you folks, but actually that feed, even though it's manufactured in Canada, is shipping right back to the United States. So, and it was going in, it was being used for fish feed in fish hatcheries and aquaculture farms. So now this is tracking into the seafood industry. So once again, you know, you go and start to measure levels in fish and in shrimp and stuff in aquaculture farms in the United States. And once again, it turns out that the levels were low. But my point here is that you've got increasing complexities. This was deliberate. These Chinese suppliers were doing this deliberately in order to increase the apparent value of the wheat gluten. Melamine is really high in nitrogen, and when you're measuring total protein content by measuring total nitrogen, you can fool the system by throwing melamine, which is essentially used as a fertilizer, into it, and thereby get more money for it. Okay, so where do we end up with all of this? We have got a food supply that is clearly global. There's no question about that. It is global right now. It isn't going to change. It's only going to grow. We've got perceptions, misperceptions, I should maybe have called this, that when you grow it locally, and this is certainly a U.S. phenomenon, it is safe. And when you have large growers, it is unsafe. That is a perception that is out there, clearly demonstrated in the United States. There is absolutely no scientific evidence to support that whatsoever. And the danger with this is that the new legislation, which I'm going to talk about very briefly in just a second, which is happening in the United States, will essentially protect the local farmers from regulatory control because they will say, we can't afford to do it. And that's part of the strategy that we've got to be thinking about here. Because essentially the examples that I've shown you really began at what you could say is the local level. It was a local pepper farmer in Mexico that was shipping up through multiple distribution channels that was ending up all over the place in the United States. The melamine was a, quote, local small manufacturer in China who simply was just doing something inappropriate. We've got multiple factors to consider as well on top of this. Obviously, food safety, which is what I've been talking about, but we've got to be thinking about sustainability, the environmental impacts, particularly in the context of the food supply, of the use of water, of transportation costs, and obviously, as a theme to this whole meeting, is nutrition in terms of is it too much food, is it too little food, or is it an imbalance of food? So you've got these multiple factors that we're trying to juggle of how to move things forward. And finally, we've got major new legislation that is occurring in the United States on food safety. And this is probably going to be the most draconian shifts in terms of regulatory change in the U.S. for, I would say, 30 to 50 years in the context of food safety. The requirements that are going to float down out of this are vast. So the challenge, how do you link all these entities together? The safety, the nutrition, the sustainability, and the impact on the environment. And I think as we move forward, if we try to work on just one of these, the others will fall by the wayside. And that's part of the difficulty, is how do you pull it all together? But I think there is probably a way, and that's the value of a group like this who bring all these bits of expertise together to say, how do we do this? But that's the challenge. How do you maximize the use of industry information and expertise? There's a ton of stuff out there, but there is a lack of trust. There is a there's all kinds of barriers to sharing the data. David talked about the lack of data between academia and the government. It extends beyond that. How do you keep local farms as part of the solution, not just the problem? Again, key challenge. And then how do you identify the achievable goals in the short and the medium term in all this complexity? Because if you don't, it will fail. All right, opportunities. Number one, broker the components to build trust across the food supply chain. Essentially, that's a role that this organization can play, is the brokerage amongst all of these players. You've got to find a champion for change. That's critical. Recognize that food needs to be safe, obviously, critically, and if it's not, certainly in the U.S., all bets are off. Local farmers can be part of the global food chain, and they can be part of a safe food chain. I believe that. But you've got to set standards, and you've got to use the science to set those standards. And then you've got to empower the local growers through education and the tools to meet those standards. If you don't, in the U.S., and I'm sure it's the same in Canada, borders will be closed. Consumers will react, and the media and the Congress will put up barriers that are insurmountable. And finally, we need to be using new sophisticated technology to make this work. We heard some really cool stuff yesterday about the use of cell phone technology, and that's exactly what I'm talking about, is when you're trying to deal with a local farmer, let's use that technology to try to move the ball forward. Concluding, global food supply is here, it's now, and it's involving everybody, but there are mutual benefits and gains that can be obtained from everybody as part of this system. And I think we've got three choices. We can follow what's going on and we'll ultimately lose the game. We can just accept it and we'll survive. Or this group can essentially lead something and it'll lead to overall prosperity, not just for the multinationals, but for the locals as well, which I believe can feed into many of the things that we were hearing about yesterday, which is really not just about producing food for your own kids and your own family, but building a system that can do that, but also be part of a global solution to the environment as well as maintaining nutrition and an adequate food supply. So with that, I'm 1 minute 21 over, so I've really blown it. I'm sorry.